It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we take a look at the complex relationship between elephants in zoos and their caretakers.
First, a federal appeals court ruled yesterday that Wisconsin's requirement for abortion providers to have admitting privileges to a nearby hospital is unconstitutional.
The suit was brought by Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and Affiliated Medical Services, Wisconsin's two abortion providers, saying that it created an undue burden on doctors, which in turn would seriously limit women's access to the legal procedure.
Earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear a challenge to similar laws in Texas.
Joining us now to discuss that Wisconsin case is WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach. Chuck, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, this law that was being challenged here in this court case, it was signed into law by Governor Walker 2.5 years ago. Has it ever been in effect at any point?
Well, the law had two key parts that the governor quietly signed on a July 4th weekend. The first part required women seeking abortions to go through an ultrasound. And the second part is what we're talking about today. That stayed in effect, by the way, the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. The part two, though, the admitting privilege law, did not go into effect because abortion providers quickly asked a federal judge to halt that provision, and it has indeed stayed enjoined or halted since.
So explain that part of the law to us. What is meant by admitting privileges? What would an abortion provider have to do to satisfy that law were it in effect?
Well, I think there's about a 30-mile radius. The abortion provider, the medical doctor, has to have admitting privileges. In other words, be able to get the local hospital where he or she has the privileges, to admit their patients. Now, of course, hospitals will admit patients on an emergency basis, but this is for more standard care. And it's a complex process. Others have reported that admitting privileges can be somewhat lengthy to get at times. There can be extensive reviews. There can be sort of only temporary admitting privileges. So, and there's also the allegation by some abortion providers that some hospitals that don't want to associate with doctors that perform abortions may make it a little tougher even for some of those doctors.
That's the argument, one of the main arguments against this law. What was the case made by the state for the need for this law, for why it would be legal and constitutional?
Well, the state alleged several things. One, that problems occurred in abortion procedures more often than the providers claim that was the case. The providers claim less than 1% do complications occur. The other main point of the state was, well, continuity of care. If there is a problem, being able to get the patient to the hospital quickly without any sort of red tape would add to the protections and health for the women.
Judge Richard Posner wrote the majority decision. This was a 2-1 vote on this appeals court panel. He has been outspoken on Wisconsin-related cases in the past. What did he have to say to those arguments?
Well, certainly, and he's been outspoken earlier this year about Governor Walker. So he wrote for the majority, the 2-1 majority yesterday, released yesterday, saying it makes no sense to abridge the constitutional right to an abortion on the basis of spurious contentions regarding women's health. Judge Posner repeated basically some of the findings that the federal district judge in Wisconsin had found earlier this year, William Conley, when he put in a ruling against the law.
Talking to Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter, about yesterday's ruling, saying a part of a state law related to abortion would remain out of effect. It upheld an earlier court decision saying that the state couldn't require hospital admitting privileges to be in place for abortion providers. Looking ahead, is this something that could be appealed? Would it go up to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the state attorney general of Wisconsin is suggesting that Brad Schimmel is suggesting he's going to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the Chicago appellate decision. The U.S. Supreme Court has already agreed to look at a case out of Texas that has some similarities, but in some cases the law there is even stricter. So the Supreme Court is going to look at this broad issue. Whether they add in Wisconsin's argument remains to be seen, but the Texas case is on the Supreme Court's docket, and we'll be hearing more of that over the next year.
I gather you spoke yesterday with Lester Pines, one of the lawyers who argued the case on behalf of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and Affiliated Medical Services. Let's listen to what he told you about the relationship between the Wisconsin and the Texas cases.
There's a big difference, and if this case is in fact accepted by the Supreme Court, that is, if a state seeks certiorari and the Supreme Court grants it, then both cases will be decided at the same time, and that may change what happens in the U.S. Supreme Court. Are we happy about this decision? Sure, we're very happy. We won this case, and what happens in the future happens in the future. But right now, this law is enjoined in Wisconsin.
So he's making that comparison with the Texas law. Have we heard from the governor's office or the attorney general on whether this case would be affected by this Texas one, whether they would end up in the Supreme Court together?
Well, the attorney general of the state says he's going to ask for the case to be included. At 6:11 this morning, the governor's office sent me a reply saying, while the central part of the law, I think they mean the ultrasound part, remains in effect, we, the governor's office, believes the portion of the law related to admitting privileges is constitutional and will ultimately be upheld. So they're standing their ground.
And Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and Affiliated Medical Services, as I understand it, they would have been affected differently were this law to go into effect. As I understand it, Planned Parenthood, many of their doctors work at hospitals as well, so they would have these admitting privileges. Is that right?
Right. And Affiliated, which is a clinic on the east side of Milwaukee, just north of downtown, and site of many protests over the years, as is the Planned Parenthood clinic in Milwaukee, will go way back 20 years or more. Affiliated says that its doctors work full-time at the clinic and don't routinely practice hospital procedures. Wisconsin Right to Life, abortion opponents, put out a press release overnight suggesting that, well, the doctors at Affiliated do not or can't get peer-reviewed. So there's some contention over that.
So on this issue, all eyes go to the U.S. Supreme Court and whether they'll take this up as part of this other case. Chuck, thanks a lot for bringing us up to speed today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee, talking about yesterday's appeals court ruling on Wisconsin's law requiring abortion providers to have hospital admitting privileges.
There's been a long-running controversy about whether or not zoos should have elephants as part of their exhibits. Critics say confining the massive and majestic animals can't possibly be humane, but supporters say zoos can be safe and healthy places for these animals to grow.
Our next guest, a photographer and a historian, wanted not to take sides in the debate over zoos, but rather to shine light on an overlooked aspect of elephants in captivity. In a new book, they document the unique relationship between human caregivers and elephants at the Oregon State Zoo, and in the process look to offer a more nuanced picture of these creatures in captivity.
Dick Blau and Nigel Rothfels join us now. Dick's a photographer and filmmaker, and Nigel is a historian of animals and culture, and they're both Wisconsinites. Their new book is called Elephant House, and they join us now from our studios in Milwaukee. Dick, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Nigel, welcome along to you as well.
Thank you.
And Dick, we're going to start with you. As Nigel points out in the introduction to this book, one of the broad themes that you focus on in your photography is relationships. So with that in mind, the two of you have explored this relationship between captive elephant and human caregiver. Why focus in there?
Well, most of my work had actually involved interpersonal relations of one sort or another, ranging from studies of polka music to the psychodynamics of family life. And I became interested in actually kind of changing the changing things up a bit, and became fascinated by the idea of humans and animals, a kind of interspecies communication. And some years ago, I had a chance to travel with a large animal vet in southeastern Wisconsin, and I was describing it to Nigel one day at a reception up at UWM, and he said, "You know, I'm writing about elephants." And I said, "Well, let me see your work," and that was the beginning of the project.
So, Nigel, why elephants? Why is this something that's fascinated you over time?
Well, the easy answer is they're really big. No, sorry, that was a bad one. The thing about elephants, and I think your introduction hit upon it, is that there are sort of a key animal for us to think through a lot of issues about humans and animals and how we're supposed to get along. I'd written a book already about the history of zoological gardens. In that process, I couldn't help but stumble across many elephants, as one does, and it just sort of seemed like there was a project in there for elephants for me. me. So that began a longer-term project about elephants in Western culture since the 18th century. And then knowing Dick and knowing his work, and I said, you know, there's an opportunity, if we would like, to sort of think together a little bit about how we could represent this relationship between keepers and elephants. And so it was kind of related to a long-term project for me, but then working in this kind of very specific context was a kind of a revelation as well.
Well, this is a pretty hot debate right now, the ethics of housing elephants in zoos at all. A lot of elephants are ending their elephant exhibits right now. A lot of zoos are, I should say. And where does that leave you with this? Not wanting to come down on one side or the other, but really just to capture what is. How did you navigate those waters, Dick?
Well, I just decided that I would go to this particular zoo, which is quite advanced in its and its attitude toward elephants.
And this is the Portland Zoo, right?
The Portland Zoo, yes.
In Oregon.
Really quite an extraordinary place. In fact, they're putting in, or they've put in now, a huge new elephant exhibit that's based on contemporary thinking about how to maintain a viable and healthy elephant life in the zoo. And it's really quite interesting. We were actually in the old zoo, and in much more proximity to the elephants and also to the keepers. And I tried not to anthropomorphize the situation. I tried not to see immediately the elephants as like wise old men. I tried to look, to not ignore the bars. This is, after all, a facility that has to hold 14,000-pound animals, but not to imagine that this was a prison and I was about to be a captive in it. So I tried to take a good, hard, unsentimental look at who was there, what they were doing, and try to understand it better.
And what about you, Nigel? How did you navigate those same waters?
Well, I like Dick, the metaphor of the zoo and the metaphor of this building is pretty obvious, and I think that most people, when they are confronted, especially with the behind the scenes settings, they reach those conclusions very quickly, and it's not it is a situation of captivity, so it is that, right? But it's also something more than that, and you know, the complexity in all this is that it's actually also a place of love, and the reason that the animals are there is because people are fascinated by them, but the reason that the keepers are there is that it's the one place that they would like to be in the whole world, because they enjoy, well, they don't just enjoy, it's a passion and a mission to try to see what they can do to improve these animals' lives under sort of circumstances which are sort of by definition limited, and so that interested us. And Dick mentioned, not wanting to see, to sort of jump in thinking that they're wise old men. But, the elephant on the cover of this book is an older elephant. He's 53, which makes him exactly the same age as me. And I knew about him when I was just a kid. And so to finally go and to meet him, his name is Packy, and he's one of the older elephants in North America. And he's probably the tallest elephant in North America. He is something quite gigantic. To finally see him, to think a little bit about his life and what that has been and how his life is sort of literally written on his body is really important, was an important experience for me.
We're talking right now with Dick Blau and Nigel Rothfels about their new photography and history book. It's called Elephant House, and it makes a study of the relationship between the caretakers and the elephants in the Oregon Zoo in Portland. And Dick, when you first started approaching this project, you realized that it seemed like there were some things that were missing in the way that elephants were photographed. What did you see?
Well, I think, I guess my first thought had to do with the difficulty in photographing elephants. They are, after all, a kind of a kitsch object in the culture. And in the art world, they are also, they produce a great many cliches. For example, the elephant as abstraction. I really wanted to try to look at them as an ethnographer might look at a people, them being both the keepers and the elephants, people he had wandered into and tried to figure out who they were, why they were doing what they were doing, and really look at it as not simply a blank canvas, but as an institution in which both animals and people were both involved.
And Nigel, you say that the caring of an elephant, it's something that's intellectually demanding, it's physically demanding, and it's also demanding of a keeper's empathy. What pictures get at that for you, Nigel?
Oh, well, so there's different things. There's a number of works in the project which has to do with the physical care of the elephants. This is not what one could imagine as sort of a natural circumstance for these animals to live in, and as a result there's a sort of wide variety of physical care that has to happen on a daily basis. This is washing them and trimming their feet, and also just, you know, some social time with the animals. Intellectually, it is demanding. One of the things about this particular profession, if you will, of being a professional animal keeper is being sort of very aware of everything that the animal is doing, but also aware of all aspects of the environment. So there's nothing casual about this. It's clear communication with the animals so that the animals know what is expected, clear communication with your colleagues so that everybody is on the same page about what each person is doing. At some level, I think we can all understand the work. I mean, it's cleaning up and it's taking care of, but it turns out just to be much more than that, and it's clearly much more than that for the people who have made this their profession. I think, you know, for Dick and me, we were clearly outsiders. We felt very there was a certain kind of privilege that we felt that the keepers and the animals were spending a little bit of time with us, and we did this, you know, over the course of several years. In the end, we don't really know. We don't really know either of those lives. But what we tried to do was just present a fairly transparent sort of view of what we think we saw.
Did you think you saw love for the keepers? I don't know how you read it from an elephant, but did you see love for the elephants by the keepers?
Yes. This job, let's look from the human side, this job is about sort of maintaining a facility and maintaining these animals to the best that they can. What makes the job meaningful, what makes it something that people aspire to do, is the moments where it's not really the job, where it's just an opportunity to hang out and to, you know, and to talk and to touch and to, you know, to share a toy and whatever it is. I don't think that this is, you know, much of a mystery for people who spend significant amounts of their time, you know, around animals. It's there is something that's deeply fulfilling for them. Definitely love from their side, from the elephant's side. You know, these elephants and even more so now than then, but they do simply have choices about where they choose to be. And those choices could sort of it turns out to be kind of fun to be near a keeper, because a keeper has things like carrots and sweet potatoes and things like that, which are fun, and they're also entertaining, and they come with things like, you know, hoses to play with and things like that, and these are relationships which build up over a great deal of time. When we see an elephant who in the case of Packy, right, who's not just worked with the same person but with generations of keepers, right? He's been there for 53 years. At one level, I think a lot of people would look at that and say, wow, that's kind of rough going. I think on another level, I think people who sort of think a little bit more about what that life might have looked like can probably realize that, Packy's had a great deal of contact with a lot of people over the years who've cared a great deal for him.
And Dick, could you leave us with some thoughts about what it is like to be near these huge and majestic animals and photograph them? I imagine there might have come a point where you felt like you were really seeing them in a way that you hadn't before.
Oh, definitely. You just don't get near beings of that size and majesty that often. And there was also a sense of danger to it as well. Elephants are actually quite dangerous. Keepers were always very attentive to where I was, always between me and the elephants. And that allowed me to concentrate in a special way. I thought I shot particularly intensely in my time in the elephant facility. When I came back, that was really it was very, very clear to me that it had been one of those near visionary experiences where you just kind of can't go wrong.
Well, Dick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Nigel, thank you to you as well.
Thank you for your interest.
That was Dick Blau and Nigel Raffles. Their new photography and history book is called Elephant House.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As holiday shopping kicks into gear, drones may be a hot item on a lot of lists. According to estimates from the Consumer Technology Association, about 400,000 drones will be sold during this holiday season.
That's a whole lot of new vehicles flying around up there, and federal regulators and others are worried that the rules currently in place aren't enough to deal with a big influx of civilian drones. A Federal Aviation Administration Advisory Committee released guideline recommendations yesterday.
Issues that come up include privacy, where and when can drones take pictures and video, then there's airports. There have been at least two cases of drones flying too close to the Dane County Airport. And many other incidents around the country. And if someone flies a drone over your house, is that trespassing? An angry homeowner in Louisville shot down an expensive drone flying over his property this last summer.
Gregory McNeil joins us now. He's Associate Professor of Law and Public Policy at Pepperdine University and a member of the FAA's Task Force on Drone Policy. Greg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Before we get into these new regulations, are we seeing a big boom in drone use, especially recreational drone use in this country?
We're seeing a big boom in drone use actually across the board, not just recreational. And in fact, the lines between recreational and consumer are increasingly blurred, where someone who might have one of the best-selling recreational devices and flies it for fun on the weekends may then, during the week, use it to do real estate photography for a friend who's a realtor and might even get compensated for that. So we're seeing a real blending of the lines between the two types of uses of the same device.
Now, what kind of rules are in place now before these new recommendations come into effect for various kinds of civilian drone use?
Sure. So presently, the rules can be summarized for consumer or recreational use as a requirement that the individual, the guidelines suggest, stay below 400 feet. If you're operating by law within 5 miles of an airport, let the airport know that you're operating. Keep the device within visual line of sight and don't fly it over people. So those are the general guidelines for recreational operators. For commercial operators, the guidelines are far more complex. In fact, you have to go through a lengthy process of getting an exemption to be able to fly. It's known as a 333 exemption. That exemption from FAA regulations requires you to have a sport pilot certificate, to file a bunch of notices prior to conducting the operation. It's a costly and time-consuming process, which when the FAA drops their new regulations for it's called Part 107, the commercial operations this summer, it'll instead be a mere written test that a person will have to pass to get themselves an operator certificate. It'll be far less burdensome and they won't need that pilot's license.
Now, the key part of these recommendations that were released yesterday seem to be a registration requirement. So for personal drone owners, what kind of drones would have to be registered? What's involved in that process?
Yeah, so previously, drones, unmanned aircraft, were exempted from the FAA's registration requirement for aircraft. At the end of October, the Secretary of Transportation made a decision that, given the proliferation in the number of uses and the reports, not necessarily the actual incidents, but the reports of incidents, compelled the Department of Transportation and the FAA to say, we need an accountability system to tie these devices to their users. And so a task force was convened. I was a member of the task force. And the ultimate recommendation of the task force was that and this is our recommendation, it's not clear that the FAA will do this, but the recommendation of the task force was that if you have a device that weighs more than 250 grams, which is approximately 9 ounces, you have to go to a website, put in your name and address, Click submit. You'll get back a single registration number, and you should place that registration number on all of your drones. And so I have 6 or 7 drones because I'm kind of a geek, and I have 4 or 5 more that are smaller that wouldn't fall into this registration requirement. But once I get that number once, I can write it on all of my drones, and then when I get bored with one and sell it to someone, I merely have to remove that number, and that new person is responsible for registering their device and updating their address.
So what's the idea there? What problems would this registration help us fix?
You know, so the Secretary of Transportation was faced with that question at the press release when he initially announced it. And I think he was pretty honest when he said, listen, the biggest thing that they're trying to do is if an incident happens, they want to be able to tie the device back to a user. And they also want people who have previously thought that this wasn't an aircraft that they were operating, that they didn't have responsibilities, to at least go through a registration process that made them aware that they were operating in an airspace system where there are other low-flying aircraft like helicopters and low-flying general aviation airplanes, and that they might be near airports even though they don't realize it. And then finally, to sort of just get those people into an understanding that they're in a system of accountability. It won't let you know what drone is flying in the air. You won't be able to look up and know who's operating it. There's really no way to do that with the technology as it exists today, but it will be able to tie that device back to someone and try and make that person feel, that operator feel, like they're part of a system of accountability.
Talking to Greg McNeil from Pepperdine University about drones. There are a lot of them out there, more and more civilian drones on the way, expected to be a big item this holiday shopping season. He was part of an effort to come up with rules, including registration for civilian drones. One objection from drone enthusiasts, as I understand it, Greg, is 9 ounces, just over 0.5 pounds. That's not a lot of drone. They're saying, hey, that's too small. That's a, you know, that's a little remote control airplane, in effect.
It is, and listen, I share the interest of enthusiasts. In addition to being a professor, I run a startup that provides airspace information to drone operators, most of whom are recreational and hobbyist users, and so those are my people, so to speak. The company's called AirMap, and that's also sort of full disclosure here. Mm-hmm. I sympathize with that concern. However, one of the things that the task force had to address was, what is the threat to a person on the ground if one of these devices were to fail while in air and fall to the ground? And then it became a physics-based calculation. What would be the kinetic energy impact of the person on the ground? And it turns out, based on a bunch of scientific studies that the task force was provided by the FAA, that a device weighing 9 ounces, which basically, if you think about a full can of Diet Coke, if you drop that from 400 feet and it hits someone on the head, there's a high likelihood of a fatality there. I do agree that is a very small sized device, but that was the rationale behind the calculation. And I should add one other thing, which is that while the size is one piece of the equation, the task force came to a series of compromises. And so a way to think about this is that if you allow the weight to be really low, you're sweeping a lot of devices into a registration requirement. And so a trade-off would be a single registration, one time and one number across all devices, right? So make it less burdensome on the filling out of the information side of things and providing just one number that can be put on all devices, because so many devices are being swept up into this. And were you to switch that around and maybe make the size of the device larger, I think that it was likely that we might have seen people wanting more onerous registration requirements beyond what was already being collected, including individual numbers for each device, which would require someone to keep returning to this database to update every time they got a new drone or every time they sold one.
Another concern, another criticism that I think is out there, is that these regulations don't go far enough. People are worried about privacy, security, trespassing, things like that. And this helps us solve those problems after they occur. It's very reactive. Something bad happens, you check that registry. Did the committee look at more proactive efforts on those issues?
So we were tasked with 10 questions. And actually, when you look at the the public Federal Register notice from the Secretary of Transportation. There were 10 questions, and then each of those questions actually had three subordinate questions. So it was about 30 questions to resolve in 3 days. and there were a variety of things that came up, like should the device be registered at point of sale? So before you could walk out of Best Buy, should it be registered? And sort of we looked at that, and there were a lot of concerns that if someone was giving this as a gift, is grandpa going to register it and then hand it off and then a re-registration? So that came up. There were lots of things that could have been more onerous and more burdensome that could have gone farther. And I think when you looked at the group of people who were assembled, people from the Airline Pilots Association, helicopter pilots, then people from the drone industry, from startups and others, the consensus view was the goal is to have this line of accountability. That was really the mandate. So make it easy for people to get into the system. Don't make it hard. Don't make it expensive. And make it a simple process that gets as many people participating in a community of responsibility as possible. And then down the road, deal with more burdensome types of things, like how do we handle privacy, which really the federal government has said that's a type of thing that's going to be handled at the local level. How do we handle trespass? Again, that's something that the federal government says will be handled at the local level. And so don't try in 3 days to solve all the problems in the world. Just try and create this accountability system by registering the device.
We're talking to drone expert Greg McNeil from Pepperdine University. Recommended drone guidelines came out yesterday. He was on that task force. Action is on the way from the federal government, and these drones are expected to be hot sellers this holiday season.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about drones and the civilian use of drones? What regulations do we need? And do you have a drone? Do you want one? Maybe one on your holiday list? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about civilian drone use in the United States with Gregory McNeil, Associate Professor of Law and Public Policy at Pepperdine University. A federal committee issued new regulations yesterday, and shoppers are expected to buy hundreds of thousands of drones this holiday season.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there need to be regulations on drones, new ones? What would you like to see in place? What worries do you have about drones? Do you use one for work or for play? And is a drone on your shopping list this holiday weekend? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Greg, getting away from these new federal guidelines a little, you brought up privacy issues a little bit, mentioned that this is something that might ultimately get sorted out at local and state levels. What kind of arguments are people having? What kind of worries are people having when it comes to drones as possible violators of privacy or their users, I guess?
Right. So this is a new technology. It provides certain capabilities that I think people have heretofore been unfamiliar with or simply not paid attention to. And so the first is the vantage point capability. The ability really, most of these have cameras and the ability to basically put a camera in a location where someone's able to see into areas that people think that they have an expectation of privacy in. And I say that in that way because, for example, if you go into your backyard, you expect that you have privacy in your backyard, especially if it's fenced with trees. But since the late 80s, the Supreme Court has said that we have no reasonable expectation of privacy from aerial surveillance in our backyards. And that's because aircraft can fly over that are able to see into our yards. And so someone in a Cessna or in a helicopter could see into our yards. They certainly could put sophisticated cameras on those. Your neighbor could go up to the second or third floor of their home and look down into your yard. And we sort of have grown accustomed to those types of privacy intrusions, and we have either an acceptance of them or a level of comfort with that. And now a new technology comes along that makes people feel like there's a new vantage point, a new observational capability. A drone's easier to get a hold of than a helicopter. And so I think that makes people reasonably troubled. On the other side of that, though, there are a bunch of existing laws that protect against peeping Toms looking into people's windows, whether they do it with a telephoto lens or whether they do it with a drone. Looking into people's backyards, for example, in California is protected if you're doing it so in an offensive way. that allows you to see someone's private, intimate, familial activities. And so whether you climb a tree to do that with a camera or whether you use a drone to do it, that's protected by existing law, certainly in California and other jurisdictions. But these are things that raise the natural concerns of people. And at the same time, we're seeing the concerns, but we have yet to see all of the potential benefits that are coming. And this is sort of like when the early adopters first got cell phones with cameras on them. And there were, most of us don't remember that there were all kinds of laws at the state, local, and federal level coming up saying, like, prior to a camera taking a picture, it must make a loud beep. And these were the types of laws that people were trying to pass. And eventually, everyone became accustomed to the fact that cell phones would have cameras on them, and the regulatory ideas and requirements dropped off because people started to see the utility of the devices. I think that's going to happen in the next year or two with drones.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Fond du Lac. John, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Really, really great program you guys have. I work in freelance video, and I know all of my clients have been wanting drone footage, and same with a lot of the other guys that I work with. And it's kind of the Wild West out there right now. So to hear that, you know, there's actually a registration process and the written test, and that there's going to be something beside the 333, which, as your guest said, is an absolute nightmare. I've tried that. It's not a pleasant experience. But to hear that, you know, finally something that is going to be enacted with drone flyers in mind, I think is really, really exciting.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Greg, it sounds like he's talking about those commercial regulations you talked about earlier coming into effect, I think you said, next summer?
Yeah, so it's looking like June or July, although Congress mandated that the FAA have those rules published by September 30th of 2015. So it's a deadline that has been slipping, although I'm pretty confident that the FAA wants to get the rule in place because the exemption process is actually very burdensome for them. So the caller, John, mentioned what a nightmare the process is. To give you an idea, the process is expensive for the end user submitting it, but it's also expensive for the government, because the government has to review each of these basically 10 to 30 page requests for exemption, and each person in the appropriate agency within the FAA has to sign off on each individual application. And to give you an idea, so far we've seen a little over 2,000 applications that have been approved by the FAA, which is more exemptions than the FAA has ever processed within the last 20 years for aircraft exemptions. And in addition to that, they're now receiving approximately 1,200 exemption requests per week. And so it's crushing their exemption system, which was never designed to handle that type of workload. And so they have a real incentive to get a rule set in place that is a formalized rule set as opposed to governing by exemption. And so I think we'll see those rules come about in June and July.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking to Greg McNeil about drones and laws that apply to them. We'll go next to Scott in Trempealeau County. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. I had a quick inquiry or a comment on this. My biggest concern is, I know terrorism is a really big thing lately, and these drones I know are capable of carrying devices or some weight to them depending on the size of the drone. Now, how are we going to regulate or prevent any kind of terrorist attack on individuals, or can these things be shot down or stopped? How do you stop it if, you know, you're in a big crowded area? What's regulating people from running these drones over the top of crowded areas?
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think of how a terrorist organization might use drones, Greg. Are policymakers thinking about that and what to do about it?
I actually testified before the House Homeland Security Committee on this exact topic. And so some of the things that we discussed were, you know, of course, what drones allow someone to do is to get around perimeter defenses, but the requirement is still that the individual have some sort of weapon on the device. And so if someone has access to explosives, is placing an explosive on a drone the best way to get the explosives into an area? Or the other example that came up in the hearing was anthrax. And so my response to the question of anthrax was, why would you use a drone to disperse anthrax when you could go to Starbucks and sprinkle it into the sugar, right? They're just better methods of dispersing weapons. That's not to say that the device doesn't provide some observational capabilities to someone who has ill will, or that the device doesn't provide some psychological impact, right? So a pretend bomb as opposed to an actual bomb might cause chaos in crowded areas. And so there are a bunch of solutions that are coming into place. For example, DJI, the world's leading manufacturer, now has restrictions that don't allow their devices to fly over stadiums. 3D Robotics, their device issues a warning. The stadiums themselves are implementing countermeasures against these types of devices in the same way that they implement countermeasures on the ground. And so there are solutions out there to push back against these types of threats, and we just have to figure out the right cost-benefit analysis of how much of a threat the device is. I think any new technology will allow someone with ill will to be able to use it in a way that might be harmful, and then we just have to figure out how to balance these. We should bear in mind that for decades, people of model aircraft enthusiasts have been able to build jet-powered model aircraft that can fly over 300 miles an hour and are filled with fuel. And as early as the late 90s, there were reports by Rand and others about how someone could use one of those remote control aircraft as basically a guided missile. And that is far more harmful than the type of device you're going to pick up on Amazon or Best Buy. And we have yet to see an attack using a remote control airplane that is powered by fuel.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Greg, do you expect to see a lot of local and state ordinances come up related to drones?
I do expect to see a lot of local and state ordinances, and I think many of them will overreach. The authority of the state and local governments really begins from the ground up to a very low altitude, probably around 100 or 200 feet. And state and local governments have authority over privacy, nuisance, and trespass. If they stay within those guideposts, I think they'll be successful in implementing some laws. But if they stray from those guideposts trying to regulate the airspace, I think they're going to be intersecting with areas of federal control.
Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gregory McNeil, Associate Professor of Law at Pepperdine University, talking about drone policy with new efforts coming from the federal government.
What's this? A piece of toast? A pretzel stick? Popcorn? What blockhead cooked all this? What kind of a Thanksgiving dinner is this? Where's the turkey, Chuck? Don't you know anything about Thanksgiving dinners?
Well, Thanksgiving, just a couple days away now. Charlie Brown is serving toast. A lot of people might go with the more traditional turkey and cranberry sauce, but there's kind of a lot of wiggle room between those two extremes.
Yeah, we're having some people over, not a ton of people. We're thinking turkey, and turkey's just a big pain, so we're doing turkey tacos this year. We've done enchiladas, we've done lasagna in the past. I'm a big fan of just, you know, I like turkey fine.
That's getting out there. What you're doing is you're really skipping to leftover day.
I know, that's true. I was thinking
you're
about that
right
a lot of times.
You're going right to the leftovers, you're skipping the turkey. Yeah, we haven't done anything that bold, but there was, no one will ever forget, nor should they, the year of the tropical parsnips, which were just a bad idea all around.
So there's two words I'll never really intersect in my life. And tropical and parsnips are those
right,
two words.
Right, no.
What? How?
Yeah, God never intended them to join together on a dinner table like that. But we tried it, and we will never do it again.
Well, are you doing a less traditional Thanksgiving meal, or do you have to have those holiday classics? Let us know about it on the Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tropical parsnips. It's the new name for Central Time here on the Ideas Network.